Hey everyone, this is Ashley Menzies Babatunde, your host and resident storyteller, and welcome to another episode of No Straight Path, the highs, the lows, and the lessons learned. No Straight Path is brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. We are digging into the human stories behind success, and my hope, as always, is that you leave the conversation inspired, motivated, and excited about your journey. Hey friends, hey, I hope you are well. So we are actually celebrating the 2-year anniversary of No Straight Path this week. It is officially this Friday, March 22nd. I cannot believe it. I want to thank you all for your support. I sincerely appreciate you. Thank you for tuning in, sharing the show, and just for sharing your thoughts with me. It really means so much. And when I joined the HubSpot Podcast Network 2 years ago, I had no idea where this journey would take me. All I knew is that something inside me told me to say yes to the opportunity, and I'm just so grateful that I did. So to celebrate 2 years of storytelling, we are going to do a special 2-part episode with someone who embodies all the things that No Straight Path represents: honesty, vulnerability, compassion, self-awareness, intellectual curiosity, a commitment to excellence, resilience, purpose, and faith. And that is my friend, Dr. Fermi Okunlami. His full name is actually Alua Fermi Okunlami, and he is affectionately known as Dr. O, but I met him and know him as Fermi. So Fermi and I both ran track at Stanford, and he has always been a natural leader. Having the opportunity to sit down and talk to him about his life and career journey since we met in 2007 was such an impactful experience. He helped me interrogate my thinking on various topics and challenged assumptions often perpetuated by society with respect to disability, mental health, and so much more. But before we get to part one of this really thoughtful conversation, I'll tell you a bit more about Fermi. He is a speaker, advocate, and physician leader dedicated to improving diversity, equity, and inclusion, and inspired by the belief that disability does not mean inability. He is currently the Director of Student Accessibility and Accommodation Services at the University of Michigan, and he is dedicated to providing student athletes with disabilities opportunities by creating and leading the Adaptive Sports and Fitness Program at the University of Michigan. Fermi has just done so much to further this mission, including serving on President Biden's Council on Sports, Fitness, and Nutrition. And in part one of this conversation, we learn all about Fermi's fascinating journey and his fresh perspective on DEIB issues. I think you're going to love this conversation, so let's get to it. All right, Fermi, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I'm just excited to have you.
Thanks for having me, Ashley, and good work with all of this.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah, you've been like big brother from Stanford track and field. I literally thought we were on the team together, but actually I met you at my recruiting trip for Stanford, but you've always just been a leader and a role model to the Stanford community, to the Stanford track and field community. So I'm just excited to be having this conversation with you.
Well, it has been a delight watching your journey from that recruiting time to then being a student athlete to now Juris Dr. Menzies Babatunde. So it's an honor and a privilege to be able to join you. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So I'm excited to learn more about your journey, and I love to start from the beginning. So can you just tell me how you grew up? Tell me about your family, your upbringing?
For sure. So I was born to two physician parents in Nigeria several years ago now. And my family started in Nigeria, but then came to this country because my parents were going to pursue postgraduate education. So when they got here, the United States didn't recognize the training they had in Nigeria. So they both had to redo their residency training in pediatrics at Howard University. So both mom and dad did pediatrics residency over again. And then my mom did her pediatric intensive care fellowship at Johns Hopkins. And my dad did his neonatal intensive care fellowship at Georgetown, before they then moved to Indiana, where my family has been sort of based ever since then. But for me, I bounced around after that. So I went to a little private school in Indiana from 4th grade to 8th grade, went to a boarding school in Western Massachusetts, Deerfield Academy, for high school. And it's at that point I started sort of getting involved in lots of things. I sang, I danced, I acted, I played sports, I was a leader. And so I continued that on to Stanford, where I then ended up being a student athlete at Stanford, ran track and field all 4 years, was captain my last 2 years, considered taking some time off to train for the Olympics, but my immigrant parents had other plans, went straight to medical school at the University of Michigan, and then we can sort of get into the professional career after that. But, you know, the upbringing was, I tell people, I was raised in the United States, but in a Nigerian house. So while we may have lived in America, the values, sort of the expectations, everything that was there was certainly from our Nigerian upbringing. And education was paramount, respect for elders, respect for self. And so some would say that we had a strict upbringing, but I felt as though my parents had rules that made sense. And they were giving us an opportunity to make sure that wherever we ended up in life, the education was something that nobody could ever take from us. And I say us because it was my sister and I, just the two of us, which is somewhat small for a Nigerian family. But I think that that's like enough of kind of like the baseline of where Fermi came from. Nigeria, coming to the States, and then bounced all over the place for education. Here we are now.
Yeah, that sounds great. And I definitely can, well, I can't certainly relate to it, but I have a lot of Nigerian friends, including my husband. So it sounds familiar. And I'm curious about your personality as a child. So how would your friends and family describe you? And do you think that your childhood personality is reflected in who you are today?
This is an interesting question because I would like to say that my personality has been fairly consistent. But if I think back, I can remember in seventh grade, this is a weird little story. In seventh grade, we went on a cruise with our family. And I was just old enough that I could do sort of the cruise things on the boat by myself, right? I didn't have to be with my parents the entire time, old enough to be able to be on your own going around. And I remember coming back from that cruise, and I felt as though it was the first time that I had sort of my own identity outside of what any sort of preconceived notion may have been, right? I had an older sister who then came before me and everything that they did. And so they knew the little brother, or my parents were, you know, either in the church or in the community, and people would know who we were. But on this cruise, it was my, I guess, my chance to create for myself who I thought I was. Unbeknownst to me, that translated into when I came back home and people said, you're different. You're acting different. And so I guess seventh grade is where my personality that I think of it as now, being sort of an outgoing, gregarious, talkative person, I think that was seventh grade, was that transition. Because prior to that, my parents would say, I wasn't the most talkative kid. I wasn't the one that was, knowing myself, I'll put it out there, I wasn't the center of attention, right? And I think that I pivoted in some way, not even a pivot, I just kind of grew up into someone who, I'll admit, I sought out opportunities to be a leader. I sought out opportunities to be very visible, and that wasn't my experience prior to that. I would hope to say that as I've gotten older, that seeking out those opportunities has been centered around providing opportunities for others, and it's less so about me, and it's about having a platform to then serve others. So this is me being very vulnerable and saying, if you would talk to people that know me, younger me, quiet, you know, maybe even shy seeming person, teenage to sort of college age me, people would probably call me a little extra. I had a lot of energy. I was all over the place. I would like to think that I was still grounded at that point. But as I said, this is being able to reflect in my years now to say, perhaps it came across as being all about me. And even though I don't want to say that that was my intention, I could absolutely see that that was the impact of a lot of the decisions I made or the actions that I took. And now I'd say that it's to whom much is given, much is expected. And the goal of leveraging whatever opportunities, network, resources, visibility that I have to be able to then open a door for someone else or provide access for others, given the fact that I know what opportunities I have been afforded. And it wasn't necessarily that I always did anything to earn them myself, right? I was born into a family that I was given opportunities. And other people don't always have that. So I think that that kind of sums up my childhood personality and what part of that I think still exists in my adult personality.
I love that. I love that reflection. And I appreciate that honesty and just, you know, thinking about intent and impact, which is a lot of the work that you do now. So We're going to get to that. But I also just love the self-awareness, and it's all about personal growth. You know, we all go through those phases in life. So it's amazing that you can reflect upon that and how you're just using your platform to help other people. And let's talk about how you got this platform. Talk to us about your journey. I know you've had several pivotal moments in your life, and that's informed the work that you do today. So let's talk about that.
Yeah. So I always knew I wanted to be a physician. Like that was, you know, I had my little kid dreams of wanting to be an astronaut and a paleontologist, but being a physician was always one of those things. And having two physician parents, some would think, oh, well, you were forced to do that. You didn't have a choice. I have an older sister. She went into law. She grew up in the same exact household, had the same expectations, same opportunities, same exposure, and she chose a different path. And I saw medicine, and I was given an opportunity to experience what my parents did. And I enjoyed it, right? The opportunity to use your mind and your hands to affect change in someone else's body and not to be sort of a savior complex type of thing, because my parents made it very clear. They are not the reason why someone survives, right? They're merely vessels through which the Lord acted. And for that reason, if they saved a life, they never took credit. But similarly, if a life was lost and they did everything that they had in their power to then be able to do, it's not their fault that the life was lost. It just meant that it was that individual's time. And so I think I had a perspective on medicine and the ability to impact lives, and that appealed to me. And I always liked sciences growing up too. So that was the decision to go into medicine. But I was very, very interested in sports, right? I played sports my entire life. My Nigerian family, however, did not want us to focus on sport, but sport was something that they allowed me to do. And I ended up being fairly good at the sports that I played and had an opportunity to go to college to play a couple of the different sports that I was in at that time. So I played basketball, soccer, lacrosse, tennis, golf, track, but track and field ended up being the one that sort of objectively, I guess, I was better at, right? It's something that you didn't need to have a bunch of, you know, recruiting videos to show as a jumper. It was an objective measurement of how far have you jumped, right? If I were a sprinter, how fast have you run? And that's something that you can then compare across schools, across counties, across states. So I was what was called a recruited walk-on. And once again, I'll be vulnerable and admit it here. I was not a Ashley Menzies coming in already. I'm sure you probably had like four California state titles before you came to us. But I was known to the program, but was not a recruited athlete that they were seeking out. And I went to Stanford for school, but knew that I was going to have an opportunity to run track as well. So I say this as a long-winded way to say I have had opportunities to have access to sport, access to medicine. Many people that are interested in medicine don't have parents or aunts or uncles or cousins or friends, especially people of color, people from minoritized backgrounds that they can look at and see what that life would be like. And so I say this because I recognize now how privileged I was. And so the path that I took to get to where I was a path that had already been charted for me in a way. I've been given the opportunities. I've been given sort of myriad ways to see how I could then be successful. And interestingly, I was talking about this earlier today. We're talking about sort of work languages and love languages, right? The work languages doesn't exist, but I sort of co-opt the love languages to then translate that into a working environment, because just like the love languages, you need to know how people respond to certain things and what people prefer and what they don't. As a boss of an office, you need to understand your employees in a way as well, and they understand you. So I was talking about this earlier today in that I don't feel like I need the words of affirmation as much, but that's primarily because I have been affirmed throughout most of my life, right? Despite the very specific times where people may have been discriminating for various reasons, I've been given access. I've won awards. I've been given leadership roles. And so I feel like I've had an opportunity to be successful because other people have seen that and put that on me, have given me that opportunity, whereas not everyone else has that. And so I'm trying to then provide those words of affirmation for others now. I'm getting off on a super wild tangent and haven't really gotten back to what my actual job is.
But I love that. No, but also I'll just stop you really quickly because I do love that, because I'm actually a words of affirmation person. And I think it's extremely important in leadership to have people, and I know it can be quite annoying to some people, but have people take those personality tests. Ask people, what is your working style? How do you like to be supported? I do it with my husband all the time. We're very different. He doesn't care about affirmation. I need it every day, right? And so you want to do that with your team so that you can empower people and inspire people. And a lot of leaders don't even think about that. What often happens in leadership is you're really great at your job. You just keep getting promoted. And then all of a sudden you find yourself in a position where you were leading people because you're great at a specific skill set, but you haven't really thought about the personalities and you haven't really thought about how am I going to inspire people to do their best work and what are their superpowers and what are their strengths and what are their weaknesses and how can I actually support them? So I love that you have this whole work languages thing going on in your practice because I think it's extremely important. So we can get back to your story, but I love that. So
No, look, this is our time. So let's make it as much of a conversation because otherwise, you know, when I give my talks, I say this very thing. I start off by telling people that I don't like giving talks. Mm. And then I stop and I say, you know, now anyone that knows me is going to say, that's a bold-faced lie because you love talking. And I say, well, I didn't say I don't like talking. I said, I don't like giving talks. What I like to do is start conversations. But then I say, however, I am perfectly comfortable and able to then talk for the next 45 minutes. And so unless you interject, I may just go and go and go. So please feel free to jump in, cut me off. Otherwise, I might just go on my own path and it will be no straight path, but I will keep talking. So, you know, the interesting part about this, and it reminds me of this analogy that I've often used that I hope you probably resonate with. I credit my track and field career for the type of leader that I am now, because I tell people as the captain, so I was voted captain of the track team my junior year and my senior year. Now, I tell people that as a junior, my primary event was the triple jump. I was not the best triple jumper even on our team my junior year, right? And so you don't necessarily have to be the best person at what you do to be a good leader. And then on the track team is made up of sprinters, jumpers, distance runners, throwers, right? I'm not out here telling the shot putter how to throw the shot put. I'm not the captain of the team because I can tell them exactly how to do their event well. But I would like to think that I was voted captain of the team because I found a way to then make sure every individual on that team felt like they had a place, right? Mm-hmm. And there was actually something that we came up with back then that, you know, I doubt that we do the same thing anymore, but we go to Eugene, Oregon for a meet, and it's probably going to be a primarily sort of distance event there, right? There are going to be people from all over the world that are coming to then run the 5K, the 10K, 15. You know, they're going to come to get, you know, world record times to qualify. But then there might be a handful of decent sprinters there, maybe a couple jumpers. But you might win the long jump, for example, with a mark that is not even the Olympic B standard. And your teammate might get eighth place in the 10K, and they might have crushed the A standard, right? Just because of how difficult the competition was. If you don't understand that difference and you just walk around puffing your chest because you got first place, you're not able to truly recognize what your teammate did because you don't really understand the times. You don't know the place. So what we did is we created a standard that says that if you say the Olympic A standard is 100, the B standard is 75, we then take everybody's marks, right? And then you make them standard deviations away from what those standards are. And we assign a score to everyone. So you may win the long jump and have a score of 52, and your teammate may get eighth place in the 5K with a score of 96, right? Mm-hmm. And that puts into perspective what your teammate just did. So that was one of the things that I was doing at Stanford to try to get people to recognize what their peers are doing, even if it's not what you do, to then have some respect, to be able to appreciate the efforts that your teammate sort of went through. Because that's a big sort of decentralized team. We practice at different times. We eat at different places. We have different regimens, but everyone needs to realize that they're part of a team. And even if you go to a regional event where there's no like team winner anymore, right? And it's there for your individual sort of qualifying for nationals, I still thought it was important for everyone to then recognize that team element. And that's what I say to my teams now. I say, look, I'm not here to be your boss because I do your job better than you, right? I'm going to empower you to do your job as well as you can, but please let me know what resources we can provide to do that and know that your colleague down the hallway that does something different is there to support you as well, even if you don't do the same work. And so it's the example that I use for why I feel as though we can have these diverse teams And you can have a leader that may not be equipped to do every single person's job, but respects and appreciates everyone's work enough that they can sort of bring the team together. And that's, I think, my athletic background, and specifically track and field, is a reason why that's something that I've been afforded to do.
Yeah. Another one. I do love that as well. And you're right. Track and field is a unique example and a perfect example of leading diverse groups, right? Because on other teams, you're going to have more similarity in the roles and you have a better understanding. As, for example, basketball, the basketball team is quite different from a track team, but that is really challenging to kind of understand what people are doing, how great they're doing, what level they're doing it at. And that's certainly reflective and transferable to a workplace. And so I love that insight. We got to get back to your career, though. We're taking our No Straight Path journey through Fermi's career. So let's talk about, you became a doctor. Let's go from there.
Yes. So finished undergrad, went to med school, matched into orthopedic surgery residency. That, at the time, I felt took my athletic background, my desire to be a physician, my love for sports, and kind of was a career that I felt as though I could help restore function to my patients. And at that time, I thought I wanted to be a pediatric orthopedic oncologist, so dealing with children with sort of musculoskeletal cancers. So matched into orthopedic surgery residency at Yale, and was, my thought was, well on my way to doing what my parents were doing and using my mind and my hands to affect change in people's lives. And in my third year of my orthopedic surgery residency, I dove into a pool and I ended up breaking my neck, becoming paralyzed from my chest down, having very minimal use of my upper extremities at the time. So I was rushed to the ER by my own peers that took care of me, was operated on by some of the faculty and my colleagues, and had two surgeries at Yale, and then returned to the Midwest where I did my inpatient rehab at what was then called the Rehabilitation Institute of Chicago. It's now called the Shirley Ryan Abilities Lab. And so I had several months of inpatient rehab. And during that time, I started to regain some motor function and I moved my leg for the first time, which kind of changed the trajectory of my recovery. But it was still, you know, the first time that I started to recognize something I hadn't seen all my life prior to that. Being an athlete my entire life, being the son of two physicians, I saw disability often. Right? I saw injury often, yet I didn't recognize how inaccessible our world is. I didn't recognize how inaccessible the healthcare system is. And so at that point, I was thrust, as I call it, onto the other side of the stethoscope, where I then realized how I had been unintentionally complicit to this sort of world of ableism in which we lived. And I often juxtapose ableism and racism for people that don't know ableism. Racism, we all understand. It is the belief that there is a race or some race that is better than other races, and we assign value based on that. We give resources, access, opportunity on that basis, and we then do not provide it to the race that we think is lesser than. Ableism is the fact that people believe that there is a certain standard of body or mind that one should have, that is what should be strived for, and that is how we build our society. That's where we put resources. And so ableism is the reason why there are things that have to be retrofitted to make them accessible to the disability community, is that we don't build with disability in mind, and those that have disabilities have to come afterwards to then fight to then get access to certain things. So as a physician, I didn't realize the world that my patients were living in. I didn't realize how we were perpetuating some of that ableism even in healthcare. And so that's a point in my life where it gave me additional perspective. I think that oftentimes people use that as this singular thing that has then created sort of the roles that I have now. And I'd say that, yes, that was a significant change in my life, right? While I did start to regain some function, I'm still a proud wheelchair user. That's how I get around day to day, is in my manual frame wheelchair. But I also have a 12-year-old son who was born the day I graduated from medical school. And that changed my life, right? I also have a sister who has had some of her own interesting journeys that has also impacted my life. I have a father who I lost to suicide a few years ago, which has been a significant change in my life. There have been lots of things that have contributed to who I am and where I am. And I think that primarily because of the stigma that is involved around disability, people assume that that one visible thing that you can see, right? I went from 6'1", 240 walking around to, you know, 6'1", 245 sitting down. And that's the only difference to me. But to everybody else, it's a huge difference. And the way that I've been treated post-injury now as a wheelchair user, completely different than when people saw me standing and walking into the room.
Yeah. Yeah. I appreciate you sharing all of that and just sharing just the complexity of your humanity and all the different things that make you who you are, even though there is one thing that stands out to everyone else. And so that's why I'm so happy that you come on the podcast to really share your story, because I certainly want to delve into all of those topics. And that's why we're making this a part one and part two. And you've really helped me interrogate my thinking about this issue as well. When we had a previous call and I said, Faramee, I want you on my podcast. You're so inspiring. And we talked about the word inspiring and how that is a complicated term for the disability community. And I remember sitting in discomfort when you were talking to me about it, because I wanted to initially say, no, I didn't mean it like that. I mean, like, you're inspiring because you're a Black doctor. And like, there's not that many Black male doctors in America, which is true. But also, yes, I do think my initial thought was he's inspiring too, because he overcame this challenging time in his life and is moving through the world in a different way. And so can you talk to me a little bit about the words we should be using, the thinking we should have? What does disabusing disability mean to you?
Yeah. And I'll first start by saying, I don't want you to feel as though you said anything wrong, right? Because one of the things I tell people is that when you've met one person with a disability, you've met one person with a disability. And so just like the Black community is not a monolith, the disability community is not either. And so while I will sort of speak about my N of one experience, and I do know that there are other people that feel this way, I don't want anyone to think that there's one way to refer to someone, or that there are certain words that just, you know, this is what they mean to everyone. But what I do like to do is get thoughts out there for people to then at least interrogate what they think, right? Mm-hmm. So not to be critical of you, but to hopefully offer you a perspective that I acknowledge I did not have myself until, as I said, I entered life on the other side of the stethoscope. So I trademarked the phrase disabusing disability, trying to demonstrate that disability doesn't mean inability. Mm-hmm. Now, this goes back to why I gave some of sort of the background of my life and the access I'd been given, because I recognize that I am where I am due to a constellation of factors, and that the reason why I have a lot of the access I have is because of what privilege I've been provided beforehand, right? However, I now navigate this world as a wheelchair user. People look at me and make assumptions about what I can and cannot do based on their preconceived notions of disability. And it's because of the resources that I had prior to my injury that I was able to then sort of get back onto a path faster than maybe the average individual without the same opportunities that I've been given can do after a spinal cord injury, right? But what I've tried to show people is I am not actually special. I am not any different than any other individual that may either enter this world with disability or that then acquires a disability as they go through their life. The difference is that I had a certain level of access before. I now see what I've been able to do with that. And I think about the people that did not have that same level of access and the barriers that are unintentionally and intentionally placed in the way of individuals with disability. And so the reason that we talk about inspiration and why some people feel like that word is challenging in the disability community, and it's actually something I don't take credit for. There's a woman by the name of Stella Young, and she had a TED talk that she called, "I am not your inspiration." And she coined a phrase, inspiration porn. Now, stay with me before you then ask, like, what's this man about to talk about? She talked about a story where she was with her parents in the grocery store and someone came up to them and said, you know, you're just so inspiring. And her parents were like, for what? She didn't even make her bed this morning. What did she do that's inspiring? I think what happens is that people look at individuals with disabilities and they expect less from them. And so that when they're just doing mundane everyday things, you feel like you just want to tell them, oh, I can't imagine how difficult it must be for you to be in the grocery store today. And I'm just so inspired by you for you being here. And then I'll say, I just needed some eggs. I don't know why this is inspirational. Now, but what I hold on to is I say, wait, now if you get to know me and you see what I do in my life and you then feel inspired by something that is inspirational, that's okay. But I think people make an assumption and they are now inspired by something that you would not have been inspired if someone without a disability did the same thing. And it's really because we have, to go back to track analogies, we lowered the bar. We lower the bar for individuals with disabilities such that they are not expected to do as much. But that's also because the world does not provide them with the same level of access, such that it's a much higher hurdle to then jump, to then do something if you have a disability, merely because of the barriers that have been set there. So there are multiple facets of sort of this world that we need to address this from, because there's the stigma of disability itself that people don't want to identify with disability. They don't want to say it. They don't want to think it. When you're a kid, you're told not to stare at the person in the wheelchair. Mm-hmm. But we need to teach our kids that, no, you can talk to the person in the wheelchair because they are a person just like anyone else. And as a child, those are sometimes the best times to then learn. You ask questions. You don't know. But when we tell them not to, that's why we're creating sort of this rift that exists between sort of the disability community and those that aren't, because we're not able to ever investigate and interrogate our beliefs and explore things because we create this sort of taboo, no, don't talk to them over there. And so that's a long-winded sort of response to that. But disability is not inability. And I think that we can demonstrate that in various ways. And that is kind of what has led to where I am in my career, because I started off as a physician. I am still a physician with my degree, but I've done multiple things since then that have led me to sort of the body of work that I now do.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And I did not feel like you were being critical. It felt like a teachable moment, just so you know. And I think it was just very helpful, because I think that when we're learning and we're growing, that is often accompanied by some sort of discomfort. And it's okay to sit in that discomfort and learn and grow. So I actually think it's a moment that I'll always think about. And then I went and actually listened to that TED talk that you suggested, and it was eye-opening and very helpful. And you know, I want to use some of this time also for you to help and educate us a little bit more, because I think it's very helpful for me, because I often view myself as someone who's quite informed about DEIB issues, but things are changing, different perspectives. It's extremely helpful to just kind of stay up and informed. And you said something that really stuck with me. You said you were treated very differently before the accident when you're standing at 6'2", over 200 pounds. And then sitting at the same height and same weight, but post-accident, and that treatment was so different. Can you talk to us about that change for you? And perhaps if you have any suggestions for listeners and how we engage with this issue and engage with disability.
Yeah. Now, first, for anyone that knows me now that may listen to this podcast, I have to make an adjustment. I am certainly not sitting at the same weight that I was before. So there are a few more pounds on that than they had been before, and I need to work on that. But the thing I tell people, and someone brought this up to me the other day from their perspective, which I appreciated. Now, their perspective I don't feel is the norm, right? It's not what I have seen most of my post-injury life. But she said to me, if you walk into a restaurant and you see people sitting down, do you think any different of them with them sitting down than if they've been standing up? And I say, no, I don't. She's like, so then why should it matter that you're a wheelchair user? I said, well, I don't think it should, but I will tell you, it is very, very different. First of all, now this is a pet peeve that people know me. People now, I mean, I'm not super young. I'm not in my 70s, but I'm not super young, right? And I'm on a college campus and I see, you know, around a bunch of student age people. And I get called buddy now more than I ever had before. And I don't just mean, I've been on campuses my entire life, right? I went from Stanford to Michigan to Yale to Notre Dame, back to Michigan. And so people infantilize me a bit more in the chair. It's palpable. People call me buddy. And I say, first of all, I'm not your buddy, right? You would usually default to Mr., Sir, Doctor, whatever, especially based on where you see me. And I see how they talk to the people right next to me. Right now, there's the intersectionality of being a disabled Black man, which we can get into as well. But I was a Black man this entire time. So I was dealing with all of the implications of being a Black man in higher ed, being a Black man in medicine, being a Black man faculty member, right? I've been dealing with all of those things. Once the disability entered the picture, it has been very, very different. And it's been a somewhat exciting social experiment at times, because people do not assume that I am who I am when we're in a room full of people, right? and they will speak to everybody else in the room that they assume is probably the boss before they come to me, right? And I know that the intersectionality component of that plays in, but it is primarily different due to the disability. Now, what I think is important to recognize in this conversation, and it's something that I try to say every time, is that not all disabilities are apparent or not all disabilities are visible. So while my lived experience is one of being a wheelchair user, and that is something that is hard to not see when you're looking in a room full of people, there are many people that will be in that room that have disabilities that I try not to call them invisible. But once again, that's just my own language, because I think that saying something's invisible is saying that I don't see you. And it's just like to me when people say, you know, I don't see color. I want people to see color because I want people to see that that is a Black woman that did that good thing, right? I want you to understand that there are certain individuals that look a certain way that have been repeatedly and systematically marginalized and discriminated against. So if you don't see color, you will not see the consistency of behavior that then revolves around people of certain race. And so for disability, I want you to see disability. I want you to understand that it's there, even if the person does not have a disability that is apparent to you, right? Now, that's a whole other conversation about disability culture, because a lot of people don't want to identify with being disabled because of the negative connotation that comes with it. And I think that that is too bad, because just like I see nothing wrong with being a Black man, yeah, I see nothing wrong with being a disabled man, even though there are people that will assign negative to both of those things.
Yeah. Wow. That was very powerful. Thank you for sharing that. And, oh, okay. Well, I feel like I have so many things that I want to say, and I can take this so many places, but I do want to circle back to something you said earlier, just about the fact that you are a father, that you unfortunately lost your father, that you have a sister that has to deal with mental health issues, and that's all informed who you are today as a human being. Can you talk to us a little bit? Perhaps you can talk about one of those stories or talk to us about a period of personal growth related to the other parts of your identity.
I will tie a couple of them together, because I would say, and it's related to the last thing I mentioned, actually, I, despite talking about the lack of access in this world, I have seen much more change with respect to physical disability, much more understanding with respect to physical disability than I have seen for intellectual developmental disabilities, for mental health challenges. And so the part of my life that I'll sort of talk about is my family and our experience with disability broadly, right? Mm-hmm. We were a family that was sort of this picture almost of perfection to other people. Two physician parents, first child goes to law school, passes the bar right away. Second child goes to medical school, matches into orthopedic surgery residency. You have three doctors, one lawyer now in this family, all successful. And to the outside world, everyone's like, oh, wow, look at that family. Everything's great, right? Now, inside, we didn't realize, many people didn't realize, and we started to find out that my sister, who is 2.5 years older than me, a wonderful person, amazing woman, intelligent, gorgeous, just amazing. She started to show some signs of anxiety, and it eventually was that my sister had bipolar. Now, this is something that is not a secret, and I'm not disclosing anything that she wouldn't want me to disclose. But I started seeing that while I was in medical school, and I was learning to become a physician and learning about mental illness, right, while I was seeing it manifesting in my own family. And I know how we felt in terms of the things that we almost didn't want to talk about, didn't want to share. I then heard how the medical community talks about patients. I saw how we use words that are not flattering to patients. We talk about our patients as if they're some other group of people and not like we are part of the same humanity ourselves. We talk about it as if we are immune to disability ourselves. We talk about it as if it is their fault in some way, though we are physicians diagnosing an illness. We make it seem like that illness is that person's fault, and we treat mental illness very different than we treat physical illness. And so I'm watching this happen in my family as I'm then joining the ranks of this medical profession where we're supposed to first do no harm. And I'm seeing a lot of harm being done to people in my own family, right? I then get to a point where we suddenly lost my father to suicide. We did not know that my father had any sort of mental health sort of challenges himself. We didn't realize, because to me, depression is an illness that a side effect or end result of unmanaged or untreated depression is suicide, right? So dying by suicide is sometimes the way I like to use it, right? Because when people say committing suicide, is as if the person took an action themselves that was their fault, right? Yeah. You don't say that someone committed a heart attack, right? Like they had a heart attack, right? Now, there may be lots of reasons that led to that heart attack. Some of them may have been somewhat in their control. Many of them may not have been, but suicide is something they don't talk about in that way, right? We look at it as if that person has 100% agency and autonomy over that decision. But I feel as though that is the result of an illness that then is not treated or managed in a way that allows them to see that that decision is not the only decision that can be made. So enter that into our world. Father, eldest brother of six. My mother also was the eldest of six. So he had six other siblings in that family, was really kind of the center of our culture and our family, who now dies in this way. And we're looking at what that means. And so now I'm the oldest grandson. I'm the oldest male sibling. And now I am responsible, so to speak, for caring for the family, caring for my mother through this time. And so that time of personal and professional growth for me was, how do I support a family that then has lost their father, is actively in the process of supporting sister and daughter who is having her own challenges, taking care of my son as a father and having to explain to him what these things are, but then living as a disabled Black man in this world and trying to then show people that all of us have this shared human experience in some way, that we are identifying disability and ostracizing people, alienating people, stigmatizing things, and not recognizing that access is the one thing that all of us need. And if provided with the appropriate access, people can then do what they need to do to demonstrate success. So I think that it wasn't a one point in time, but it was looking at all of those experiences and how those have shaped me as a physician, how they've shaped me as a father, how they've shaped me as a brother, how they've shaped me as a boss, how they've shaped me as a friend, to then see how I want to then live the rest of my life and how I want to encourage my son to live the rest of his life, seeing disability, recognizing that it is there, knowing that it's diverse in its manifestations, and knowing that individuals with disabilities are no less important, no less capable or competent or qualified than anyone else, and that there's no line that we draw between those that are disabled and those that are not. We all are on some sort of spectrum or continuum, and it just depends on what sort of additional factors are at play in your life at that time as to what level of access or resource or support you may need to be able to then be successful.
Thank you for listening to another episode of No Straight Path, the highs, the lows, and the lessons learned. Remember to share the podcast with friends and family. And my hope is that these stories help you navigate your No Straight Path journey. If this content is adding value to your life, and I hope it is, please take a few minutes out of your day to rate the show and write a review. You can click the link in the show notes to write a review. It helps other listeners find the show, and I just really appreciate it. Have a lovely week, embrace the journey, and remember, you're not alone.